the National Archives podcast series. This talk is called Written Treasure, Correspondence from Captured Ships, 1652 to 1815. It was presented by Dr. Amanda Bevan as part of the summer lecture series on Thursday, the 29th of August, 2019, at the National Archives, Kew.
Everyone, welcome to the National Archives. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. My name is Jenny Orme. I'm head of our Collections Expertise and Engagement Department, and it's my pleasure to be chairing the event this evening. So this is the final talk in this year's summer lecture series, which is kindly supported by the Friends of the National Archives. This year, the series intersects with our research priorities on openness, access and use, and people, place and rule. Our speakers have been exploring mechanisms and modes of communication between citizens and the state, and each have drawn on the National Archives' really rich collections, but perhaps none more so than this talk this evening. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Amanda Bevan, who is head of the legal records team here at the National Archives. Since 2018, she's been working on a major international project to catalogue, digitise and discover what is contained in the undescribed prize papers. These are papers which were seized from wartime ships captured between the 17th and early 19th century, and some examples of which you'll be talking about this evening. Now, it's hard for me to express quite how big and exciting this project really is. It is a 20-year partnership digitising everything captured to be made readily available online. As Amanda described it to me, it will be something of a virtual delivery of centuries-old undelivered mail, but now to everyone across the world, rather than just those that it was intended for who never received it. So you can imagine what these letters could contain is so exciting and so much to uncover. So it is, without further ado, my great pleasure to introduce Amanda Bevan.
War at sea is normally seen in the general imagination as this kind of thing, the Battle of Trafalgar. It's very much big battles, big ships, big events, big consequences. In fact, war at sea at this period of time also included many other things, but particularly the disruption of trade. The view is that if you disrupt trade, you disrupt the enemy's economy. He's not able to pursue the war effort so much. The war will stop. The way that it worked was that the Royal Navy and our privateers took enemy or neutral ships, and our enemies took English, Welsh, Irish, Scottish, and colonial ships. And here we have two English ships which are taken by a French privateer. I love these pictures. It was a log of the French privateer, the Prince de Conti, and they drew or painted in it, in the log, every single ship that they met. So they painted six altogether, but most of them were neutral ships. And these are the two English ones which are captured. You can see they're quite different, so I think they are pictures of the individual ships. Does everybody know what privateers are? A privateer is not a pirate. A privateer is a private ship of war, which is normally put together by a conglomerate of merchants who want to make money. The privateers have a large crew. They go out to sea. They're not paid. They only get any reward if they capture ships. Particularly, they want to capture large, expensive ships like this. This was a fleet of French ships full of Spanish silver. They'd been commissioned by the Spanish because the Spanish were at war with us. So these French ships were bringing Spanish silver back from South America. Unfortunately, war was declared in the middle of their voyage, and they ran into a group of privateers who made an enormous amount of money out of them. The other kind of prize that a privateer or a Royal Naval ship wants, of course, is something from the East Indies, like a fat Dutch East Indiaman. The Dutch East India Company was the richest company that has ever existed in the world and is said to be richer than the top 20 companies now put together. So privateers go out to sea with lots and lots and lots of crew. They capture ships, they decant the crew onto their ship, and they put some of their crew onto the captured ship, and they send it to the nearest friendly port, where it's condemned as good prize, and it's sold, and the money goes to them. But this is all put through the High Court of Admiralty. And so this is why I've got these things, because they're treated as legal records. They are exhibits in a court case. Royal Navy has pretty much the same kind of system, except the naval sailors get paid. They're really supposed to sink shipping if they can. They, you know, if they can't capture it, they're supposed to sink it. And if they do actually capture ship and make money from it, then the Admiralty gets a slice. The Admiral gets a slice, and then it goes down in degrees by where you are on the hierarchy. Now, in 1665, the Navy hit lucky. Two huge Dutch East Indiamen were taken in fight by the Navy. They'd been coming around from the East Indies and trying to avoid the Navy, which they knew was in the North Sea. And so they'd gone northabout, round. They knew it was in the North Sea and the Channel. The Channel is really, really dangerous for shipping coming up. So they'd gone northabout around the top of Scotland. They'd stopped at Bergen on the way. The weather was absolutely appalling. They'd managed to get quite far down the North Sea when the Royal Navy snapped them up. Two enormous Dutch ships called the Phoenix and the Slotheny. And they were eventually brought into port. And Pepys, of course, went to have a look at them. And he saw, inside these two ships, the greatest wealth lying in confusion that a man can see in the world. He obviously gone down into the hold. Pepper scattered through every chink, you trod upon it, and in cloves and nutmegs I walked above the knees, whole rooms full, and silken bales and boxes of copper plate, one of which I saw opened. I should say this is not supposed to happen. All this cargo is supposed to be kept intact, and the admiral of the fleet, who had allowed his men to effectively loot the ship, got sacked. Okay, and it was an enormous kind of like scandal. So you're not allowed to what they call break bulk. If you do that, you're almost a pirate. Let's jump forward now to 1672, the third Anglo-Dutch War. We only started in 1652 with the first Anglo-Dutch War, so this is the third one in not a very long period of time. 1672 is the Dutch year of disaster. It's when half the Dutch Republic was occupied by invading French armies. The Dutch responded by opening their water line, which floods half the country. It's a specific line of defence. They turned to William of Orange for a better defender, a better military leader, and they murdered their Republican leader, Johan de Witt, which I think is, you know, really quite amazing. It was also the peak of the Little Ice Age. Winters were brutal, bitterly cold. Here we have a Dutch East India ship. In January 1673, it's a ship called the Wapen van Hoorn, or the English called it the Arms of Hoorn. Hoorn is a place on the Zuider Zee at the time. And it was limping up the English Channel. In the dreadful weather of the last 5 weeks, she had lost three of her four anchors, three full sets of sail, and 40 of her crew of 280 men. So she's in a pretty bad way. She managed to beat her way up the channel, past the dangers of Chesil Beach, which is the home of so many shipwrecks, past the Isle of Portland, and again a dangerous place, bound for home, until nearing the Isle of Wight, she decided that, or the captain decided that they'd had enough. There was 7 foot of water in the hold. She was sluggish, hard to turn. So they turned before the wind and turned back to Portland, where this great Dutch East Indiaman ran herself aground within spitting distance of the castle. Her captain tied plates of lead to a great packet of letters, papers, bills of lading, invoices and writings, and flung them overboard. This is what you're supposed to do if you're captured. Fabian Hodder, the governor of Portland Castle, took over the ship, coming out in a rowing boat, I think. Now, I think they were really disappointed. Here is a fat Dutch East Indiaman coming and landing itself on your doorstep. But it turned out not to be full of treasure. It was going in the wrong direction. It had spent 5 weeks trying to get out of the channel, not to come back up the channel. And, even worse, it was laden with provisions and bricks. Apparently the bricks were to build a fort out in Batavia, the big Dutch place out in Indonesia. She was also stuck fast and couldn't be refloated until a convenient rumour spread that under those bricks there was gold, and then all the locals came to help remove the bricks. However, from our perspective, I think there was some treasure left here. 120 of the letters were fished out of the sea, 4 bundles of letters. Now, I think they must have been wrapped up in some kind of tarred paper, because we have them and they're not soggy. They were dried out and sent to the High Court of Admiralty in London, and before they went, Captain Hodder read them and listed what they were about. And he did it in more detail than usual. If you capture a ship, you're supposed to do this. But he just went a little bit further than usual. So, what we have here is one of the letters, and you can see some more next door. And what they are is letters to and about people like these. So this is what Hodder says. Number two is a letter by a wife complaining of the sadness of the times, wishing herself with her husband. You see, like a good captor, he's numbered the letters. Number five, his sister is dead and they have war with England. Number seven, private concerns with the relation of the French proceedings and the murder of the De Witt brothers. Number 20, all our friends are in health, but the French have taken several towns. So you can see that there's a bit of information in there. He's a bit more interested in the kind of like the military stuff than the family stuff. And after a little while, he starts getting bored with it and says private letters of no moment. Which, however, recently, in the last few years, people have started to use these papers more. And Judith Brouwer, a Dutch historian, has worked on this collection. And she has come up with some different translations. Dear husband, it's hard to tell you exactly how unfair and unpleasant it is for me, now that you've left again for the East Indies. No matter what, I miss your presence, which I'm longing for more than anything in the world. Another wife says to her husband, a sailor, you write to me that you're holding your pillow at night, lying in your bunk and imagining it's me you're with, my dearest, and you tell me I should do the same, but it's all in vain. And then a mother, I was forced to send our son to sea because I couldn't feed him anymore, and he's still so young, he's only 9 years old. Only think how much it hurts me to send him away. I can't bear it. So please help me out of my misery. Please be merciful to me and your child because he's so young. Please send some money home. So Judith Brouwer thinks, having looked at these letters, that what they're really about is daily life in wartime, survival and uncertainty in a really, really hard time. She says they're about absence, longing and marital strains, parents and children, children growing up, families without fathers, child and parental mortality. And then misery, the financial problems and poverty, disease and death. So no wonder Rembrandt's people look a bit miserable. The only thing unusual about the arms of Horn is that she ran herself aground. These letters that were on her are quite typical of many of the letters that we find in the captured ships. And they differ from letters which you normally find in archives. These letters were never delivered. They're never read by the person intended. They're never lost by that person, never discarded, never destroyed, never opened and flattened and put into an archive, sewn into a book, denatured, never lost the whiff of the sea about them. And I think this is the treasure that's been left for us to discover. As my husband described it, the written treasure. Now, let's have a little bit more of a look about the letters. This is what actually makes them rare. All nations use courts to prove the legality of their captures, but only the English High Court of Admiralty kept the letters, as far as we know. And so these, we kept all the papers found on captured ships, and they've now become known as the prize papers because they're about prize taking. We hold about 160,000 such letters, we think. They're taken from about 35,000 ships, but not all those 35,000 ships carried letters. They're kept by the prize court as potential evidence in lawsuits. And they kept them quite well as well. They kept, if it's a small collection, they keep them with the court papers that were used to prove whether it was an enemy or a neutral ship. If it's a really large collection, they put them to one side and made a note of where they were. They're in 19 languages so far. Most of them are opened on capture so the court could see if they proved enemy or neutral status, but very many are not, especially as you start getting some really large collections. They don't bother to open everything. Most of them were mailed for delivery during the voyage. Some were private archives kept on board because, of course, the ship is home to many people for quite long periods of time. So you get the captain's archive, the mate's archive. Other people, apart from me, think that they like treasure as well. So we have researchers with many different interests who've been using these probably over about the last 15 years. And they say things like, the prize papers are a treasure trove because they contain information on the emotions of ordinary people. Or, if you're a linguistic scholar. Most language histories are based on highly formal texts from a small minority of the population. But the prize papers provide handwritten sources from writers formerly invisible, and that is very true. Many of the people whose letters we have here are not the kind of people whose letters normally survive. They don't have family archives, they don't have family estates, they would have just gone, probably eventually used to light a fire or something. And another person, who starts out as an economic historian but moves on, they reveal complex networks of international commerce, but most of all they open a window to the intimate connections that existed between family members living oceans apart. Now, to join this choir, I would say they also reveal the workings of the relationship between slavery and sugar, sugar and wealth, the huge consumption of new commodities by European populations, and the expanding European economies. All these papers were kept first by the court and then in record offices, two record offices, in fact. So we start out, here's the court up here. It's the same court building that's used for the probate court, because it's occupied by civil lawyers, so they use church law for probate, marriage, divorce, that kind of thing, and they use international civil law for the prize papers and other litigation in the High Court of Admiralty, because, of course, they're often dealing with foreign nationals. After the court got a bit too full of these papers, they sent them off to the Tower of London, which was a record office for many, many centuries. Until in the 1850s, our old building at Chancery Lane was first built, first opened, and every single government department in the country took the opportunity of dumping things in it. And at some unknown point, and I think I'd like to say it's in the Tower of London, some of these really large bundles of letters got completely muddled up, so muddled up that I think they must have fallen off the shelves into a huge heap and just got shovelled back into the wrong sacks. And they still are disordered, unfortunately. Now, we had them for about in our custody, because, of course, the Public Record Office became the National Archives. We had them in our custody for about 100 years before anybody really did anything with them. And this was Mr. Gascoigne, who looks remarkably like my grandfather. Mr. Gascoigne worked on the papers of two of the 14 wars that occupied this period. And those were the War of Austrian Succession in the 1740s and the Seven Years' War in the 1750s and 60s. And you can see here, he worked on a combination of both the court papers with the small collections and the bigger collections which got disordered, and he did it all with index cards. He did a fantastic piece of work. So he had two sets of index cards, one which went with the documents and one which went into an index drawer. And then, unfortunately, he died before anything else could happen with them. So the drawer of index cards got put away in a series which later got named Z-Box, Abandoned Editorial Projects, where we found it about 10 years ago, I suppose. At this period of time, research was a real lucky dip for an increasing number of people. I think knowledge of it spread by word of mouth, really, at this time, before people started publishing from it. The papers used in the court were really poorly described, so they're described as a whole box or 10 boxes, ships beginning with A. So that's the Annabelle, the Amity, the Aimable Louise, whatever. You don't know what's in them. The large bundles of letters were boxed randomly, and they were described as Dutch, Spanish, French, various. Now, my colleague Randolph, who has been working on these large bundles, has explained to me, or rather hasn't explained to me, has told me that he does not understand why letters in French on a French ship coming from a French colony to France with a French captain and a French crew were described as Dutch. But they were. Now, research really was a lucky dip at this. It's only like, I mean, for some parts of the collection, it's still like this. But one of our colleagues on the project that I'm going to talk to you about a little later, Annika, from the huge 20-year project that we're working on, started her research when you had to work on a lucky dip. And she was working on ill health in the French Caribbean colonies. And she wrote, in the course of my research, I've looked at several thousand letters from the prize papers. A lot of my research could essentially be described as flying blind, never knowing exactly what a box would contain. So I would look to see, did it have anything from the French Caribbean? And then I have to open every single letter to see, did it have anything of relevance to me? And then, if I wrote about it, I had to cite it only by the box. And if anybody, like my PhD examiner wanted to check the references, they had to go back to that box and open every letter. So you see, this is not ideal. But things did start to get popular, largely because the Royal Dutch Library came up with some money and we agreed to do a joint project with them, just looking at boxes in random to see if we could identify Dutch things. That started in 2005 with my late colleague Alistair Hansen, who, unlike me, was a multilinguist and had spent some time as a diamond trader in Amsterdam, so he was obviously a suitable person for this. The Dutch, as a result of the work that they did here in 2005, have published 5 volumes of essays on these. And then they had this very popular TV, Dutch TV programme, which is not... I'd like to get a joke out of this, but I can't quite do it. It's not who do you think you are, it's why did you never write, I think. Where they deliver the letters to the descendants. And this is apparently it's an incredibly popular Dutch personality. As things started to get used more, you could see that documents start to get damaged. This is a lovely, lovely set of silhouettes which was sent by a German pastor out to his brother in Colombo. And when they were originally found, I don't know, can you see this letter down here? Can you see these marks here? The silhouettes were loose in there, and you can see the kind of like the stain from the ink. Now, the rest of the box hasn't had any work done it at all, but these have been got out and shown to almost every VIP that has come to the archives since about 2005. So, you know, every ministerial visit, every ambassadorial visit, these come out and they get shown. And as a result, can you see the damage that's up here? This wasn't actual damage that anybody did. It was damage caused by the really, really heavily acidic ink just reacting with more and more light as they got shown. And only just now, about 2 weeks ago, conservation work finished on them with my colleague Helen Mayer doing an amazing piece of work. I thought we were really shocked when we saw how damaged these had got. Then after the kind of like the jamboree of the TV programme, there was a really serious project by Dutch linguists who looked at this and found amazing examples of what you might call basically the kind of like the underclass writing, people from different social groups, people who would normally not be heard. They also found very, very many examples of dialect they weren't expecting, and they discovered the only written example of a language from the Caribbean. They were thrilled. They called it Letters as Loot, which tells you what they thought about us and our claims to actually, it's a legal process. No, they think it's pirates. But Dutch people were doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. In 2013, responsibility for the prize papers at the National Archive passed from the digitisation department, who'd been digitising all these things for all these people who wanted to see stuff, and it passed over to my department and to record specialists. And because I'm a mug and it's legal records and it's a court, and my naval specialist didn't want them and our letter specialist didn't want them, and I kept looking at them and thinking, I don't understand this court, I don't want them either, they came to me. And the first thing we did was we created 30,000 new descriptions for them from the court's own indexes. You can see they're not brilliant descriptions. So like the first ship up there is called the Fortuna, and the master was Niels Hansen, and that's now in our catalogue. So if you know you want the Fortuna, Master Niels Hansen, you're lucky, there it is. If you don't know what it's about, it doesn't help you. Oh, we also did some publicity of our own, and with the Friends of the National Archives, who have been hugely supportive of all the work we've done on this archive, they commissioned Anna Brass, a film artist, to explore the papers. She made 3 really nice films based on letters from a particular ship, and she's also made various other films about the project and about the physicality of letters. 2014, we had a huge, huge international conference here. I'm zipping through all of this because I'm showing you we're trying to raise consciousness of this huge archive. It's far more than TNA can manage to do by itself. We can't catalogue it down to the level of detail that it needs so you can find the letters from individual people. It's got to be a partnership. And we spent years looking for partners, and partners spent years trying to find money. So we had 2 major partners. The first was the Dutch, who wanted to do Dutch stuff. So in 2015 to 17, we spent 2 years cataloguing Dutch boxes and discovered that all these things, so many of these things, were really out of order. And then in 2018, last January, we became full partners with the University of Oldenburg in Germany with an absolutely amazing 20-year research and digitization project. It's funded by the German Academies of Science, who are only interested in 20-year projects. They're only interested in things which will become freely available and which will be a source of worldwide importance. And I think the prize papers fits that bill. And the person who did all of this was Dagmar Freist at the university, who went from December 2015, she came and said to us, I found this amazing thing, this amazing German Academy's funding body, but the application has to be in 2 weeks. So we put it in, and they were interested and, you know, encouraged, and we kept having to go back and work on it a bit more. At least Dagmar and Christina had to work on it again and again and again, with their colleagues, Lucas, Annika and Jessica, who had all done PhDs on the subject matter. We now have a wonderful arrangement whereby we have people from Oldenburg come here for 4 months at a time on a rolling basis. And then we have two photographers here who do really specialist photography of this. It's not a straightforward digitisation. They're really concerned to try and capture the materiality, the physicality of the letters. And then what we do in TNA, the TNA staff, is we sort describe number. There's me, half of me, and there's my colleague Randolph, who does the fantastic stuff. And sometimes we have Andrew Little, Rhiannon Marcus, and Helen Watt, who I know is here. Helen has done some amazing stuff for us with Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch letters. We've got 2 volunteer projects, 4 volunteers working on the American War of Independence, 3 volunteers cleaning and packing documents with Jamie Beveridge from Conservation, and they also have been cataloguing the printed appeals. And then there are project conservators paid for by the Oldenburg people to prepare the things. And this is going to go on for 20 years. Now, that's the bit about how hard it is to raise money to do archival projects. This is a bit about how interesting it is. And one of the things that we've learned is that letters sent by land were charged by distance, which everybody knows, but letters sent by sea generally went free. They were entrusted to a particular captain who made money on the cargo and was obviously building up his networks and friends and credit. And they look like this. So this is a letter which is delivered by land. It's delivered to an English sailor to collect at Mr. John Whitford at the Three Shads, Shad Thames, London, which is right on the waterfront, quite a seedy part of Rotherhithe at the time. You can see here, it's got a date mark here and a post stamp, a stamp for the post office. So this has come from Dartmouth up to London. Here is the mark saying how much has got to be paid, and I can't read it. But it's a very similar mark to the kind of marks you get on lots and lots and lots of delivered letters. We're going to see some of his letters a bit later. Now, this is what letters look like that we find. They come in packets. Okay, so one letter will contain other letters. Not always, but significant numbers do. And if you can see down here, the outer wrapper here forms the envelope and is written on, so it's a letter in itself. And then inside it, you've got letters. So this is going to Dublin. And inside here, you've got letters going to Dublin, to Bordeaux, that seems a bit odd, and to Galway. The Bordeaux one must be a letter which has been sent from somewhere else in France to Bordeaux to be sent back to Dublin, so from somewhere inland. When we digitise them, we try and do them like this, first of all, so that you can see the relationship between what's in each packet. If you just take them out and do them flat, you lose all that relationship. It's like every other archive of letters. Letters are not in their context, so we're trying very hard to maintain the context of the letters. And this is where the letters will be taken. They'd often even be written in a coffee house or a tavern, like the one of the Three Shads at Shad Thames, maybe. Probably wasn't quite as salubrious as this. And letters are either left there to be collected, or they're taken there for delivery in a sack like this. You can see here it's got a hook, a loop. It would be hung on a hook, and then people would choose which one they wanted based on where it's going, maybe, or if they know obviously where it's going. They wouldn't just choose the master if he was going in the wrong place, but they look for ones going for, say, to Rotterdam or Ostend or whatever. And this one is coming from St. Eustatius in the West Indies to Rotterdam. This was not known about before in this level of detail, and when we showed these sacks to a philatelic historian from the British Library, they were absolutely amazed. They'd never seen them. Passengers could also be given letters to be delivered. So this ship from Mexico had 60 passengers with their own papers and with mail that other people had given them. So all those little boxes there are papers which he's identified as being in the custody of a particular person. It took weeks to load and unload ships. People had time to write and choose the ship for their letters. And you can see why it took weeks, because everything is packed in barrels or boxes. And then these barrels or boxes have to be taken out to the big ships if they're not in a large port with a quayside. And it just takes forever and ever. Now, in wartime, letters with a dangerous nationality were hidden in the cargo or the captain's cabin, and we have lots of descriptions about how the captors, searching for them, would find them. So they'd see kind of like a hook with a little string disappearing behind the carving of the kind of like the wainscot, and they would pull it, and at the end of it, they'd discover a whole lot of letters showing that the ship was of the wrong nationality or trading from the wrong port, and then the ship would be confiscated. So what happens? A ship is stopped or captured. The ship's papers are inspected. The captain or the lieutenant goes across and asks to see the ship's papers, and they're produced and he looks at them. If it's a friendly or neutral ship and not carrying warlike stores, it may be let go. If it's an enemy ship or a neutral ship carrying warlike stores, anything that would help the war effort, then it will be taken as prize. About a third of all the ships taken are neutral, and after a great deal of trouble and effort, the court makes them give everything back, including any papers found on the ships. Most merchant ships surrendered quickly. Naval ships tended to fight. We've discovered that most of the ships captured are really quite small. It's not fat Dutch East Indiamen or silver ships. It's just kind of like general trading ships. The captors have to collect and inspect all the papers on the ship. They have to search for hidden papers or evidence of nationality, sail the ship to the nearest port, take some of the crew to testify, swear all the papers are handed in. Those are some of the ship's papers. Only, we think, 20% of these ships carried letters for delivery across the world. But that's quite a lot, and we still think it's 160,000 letters. Here's a kind of example of a small trading ship, the Orange Tree, bound from Libourne to Amsterdam, laden with wine, chestnuts and walnuts, taken in 1664 by HMS Sawlings and brought into Rye. So now we're cataloguing the captors as well, which opens up a whole new area of interest for people. Quite typically, the crew were examined in a local pub. Rye is not a standard port for ships to be taken into, but it did have the Mermaid Pub then, and it still has the Mermaid Pub now, so that's why I chose it. And then all the examinations of papers are sent up to London. Now, having explained how the kind of like the postage system works, I need to talk to you very briefly about the trade routes, because obviously letters go on the trade routes. You have two kinds of trade routes, the older European ones and then the newer colonial ones. And these are the kind of like standard cargoes you find from France: wine, brandy, turpentine, prunes and rosin. Loads and loads of prunes, and they stop when the sugar trade starts, so I think they're possibly using them as a sweetener. In the Mediterranean, olive oil, soap, fruit, wine, camel hair, camel coats maybe, alum and silk. In Ireland, Ireland is a really, really big trader. Beef, butter, tongues, tallow, pork and salmon. So you can see all the food that's pouring out of Ireland into the European trade system. From the north, iron, timber, wheat, wax, potash, saltpeter, herring, loads of herring and linen. And then Newfoundland, which I'm counting as an old trade because it's been going on for years, cod, whale oil and whale bone. And we have some really quite large numbers of dead whales reported in these papers. This is a book, two books, which have been published based on correspondence from between Bordeaux and Dublin on the wine trade. It was only 125 letters that were found on this ship. It's an Irish ship. It's a friendly ship. It's actually a British-Irish ship. And it was collecting wine, which had been paid for before the declaration of war, which is apparently okay. It had passes from both sides, but it still got stopped. And this was full of letters from all kinds of people: domestic servants, governesses, students, priests, clerks, common sailors, small-time merchants, and prisoners of war. Here's a letter from one of the prisoners of war taken off another ship and imprisoned in Bayonne Castle, which apparently was a really horrible place. He's writing to his wife back in Ireland. "Dear Betty, your remissness in not writing to me since the 22nd of November is a very great crime, and it's a barefaced coldness and is unprecedented in this castle. I can count within this 5 weeks 114 letters from the different parts of Ireland came in here, and mostly by way of Bordeaux and the ships belonging to Dublin and Waterford under French colours. The post goes out of Cork 3 times a week, and you're not barred from sending by way of Rotterdam. You have your easy bed by night in your warm house, while I'm confined within this dark castle where is nothing but bare walls and a cold floor to lie on. What I like about it, though, is it shows quite clearly how the Irish have an attitude towards trade, which is, we trade up and down the West Atlantic, and we do it in war and peace. And they do." Okay, these 125 letters have generated two books, They've informed a film about the Bordeaux wine trade, largely because they didn't know that such letters existed, and when they saw the books they were amazed, and when they saw rude remarks about how awful the Bordeaux wine was, they still decided that they'd go ahead with it. But they've also provided trial transcriptions for the prize papers project itself. We're not doing transcriptions at the archives, we're not looking at the letters in particular, so that the things I'm talking to you about are things that I've come across through other people or just through sorting myself. What we're trying to do is to say what documents are there. So we describe the court papers and then we say, and 100 letters, numbered 1 to 100. Okay. But the project, the prize papers project in Oldenburg, will describe every letter. These 125 letters went to all these different places in Ireland. We also have private archives. This is the father, Michael Heusch, the father, who's writing from Archangel in Hamburg to his son, who's learning to be a trader in Venice and Genoa and Marseille. He was quite happy for him to go to the Rialto every day as long as it was business. But he got very cross with him when he said, I see that you wish to go back to Venice, which is unnecessary since you've already been there. And there is not much gain to be had from the carnival. I think the young man probably thought quite differently. We've also got a huge private archive from a German who was trading in France. He was in the re-export business of French colonial produce, so sending it back up to Northern Europe, which was a really, really big business. And his entire business archive got confiscated when he decided to relocate back home for his wedding. So it's rather a shame. He never got it back again. But we also have letters in other languages from other cultures based in Europe. So this is from Christian and Jewish Syrian merchants. And this letter is from a young man in Marseille back to his father. These people have very strange manners. Today a lady brought 10 lengths of fine Damascus brocade without once asking me to reduce my price. She paid, ordered it to be wrapped and delivered to her home, then simply walked out, leaving her embroidered handkerchief on the counter. Now, mid-distance ships, so we're moving slightly out of Europe, not quite too far, to Tenerife. It's one of the first of the Sugar Islands. For some reason, it's a really, really busy crossroads in Atlantic trade. And this is the ship, the Franciscus, coming from Tenerife to Hamburg and stopping off in France. There was a big international community living in Tenerife, and we have papers from an English Catholic family who are living out there. And it's quite amazing, I think, to get a whole collection of letters like this from one family, from all the different members of the family. So we have the mother, Ellen, Peter, her son, the head of the family, Christopher, who's a priest, and don't we know it, Thomas, who's been trading as a merchant in Cadiz and has just come back for a holiday, and then the little ones, Joseph and Nelly. And at school in France, in a dull grey part of France, not lovely, bright Tenerife, we have Andrew training to be a priest at the English College at Dowie, and Catherine at the Poor Clares at Dunkirk, and these are really famous places where English recusants go. Now, they've got several letters. Mother is nice, and she sends Catherine lemons, marmalade and little sugar sweets, which I think must have been boiled rather than these fancy things. They wouldn't have lasted very long. Andrew a guinea as pocket money. Christopher writes in Latin, show off, to test his younger brother. Thomas, Joseph and Nelly write nice letters of good wishes, but not much substance, except Nelly's just got over the smallpox, so that's okay. And Peter tells them both off big time. He obviously takes his position as head of the family very seriously. So Peter says to Catherine, who I judge must be probably about 12, I received your letter by Captain Forrestal in Spanish. It was needless to write to me in that language. No one would believe you were educated with the English ladies if you write in Spanish. And obviously she's been living on a Spanish island all her life, but Spanish is not good. My dear sister, let me entreat you to mind your learning with cheerfulness, your music with spirit, and your dancing with grace. Now to poor old Andrew, though, who I think is probably about 13, 14, I hope you'll mind your study in writing, ciphering, and dancing, when he's allowed to dance, as this will conduce to your future happiness. Consider what a disappointment it will be to us, as your return, at your return, to find you as ignorant as when you went. Andrew, you cannot plead the want of genius was your misfortune, nor yet good example. What a burning shame will it be to you when you should be reproached that one blockhead came from the seminary, and that was one Andrew Russell. Leave off your childish play, which is ridiculous in a collegian. I think, poor old Andrew, I feel quite sorry for him. And then just one more letter from this collection. John Cross to his father. John Cross is writing to his father, who's a merchant in London, and he's very carefully put to be delivered into his own hand. He's changed his mind as to who he might entrust it to. And if you read it, it's absolutely full of political fury. Alas, all our nobility and gentry are become insatiable, covetous, and mind nothing but to hoard up immense treasure to enrich themselves and their posterity, and do not care what becomes of the merchants, and have no regard for the honour of their king, or the interest of their fellow subjects, if they do but keep their fat posts. He also hates the Prime Minister. Then we've got some lovely letters, which you can see in the film, where William Farrell writes three different versions of the similar story to his father, mother, and cousin. Let's move on to the slave trade. Slave trade's a triangle trade, very, very famous. So you've got manufactured goods going down from Europe to Africa, enslaved Africans going over to the Caribbean and North America, and raw materials, coffee, etc. Coffee, sugar, cotton, tobacco coming back. But we would also add from the prize papers two really important trades, the provision trades. So you've got Ireland and France pouring provisions and goods. Of course, England would be doing it too, but we don't see England in this trade because we don't have the captured ships. And you get a lot of cod, dried fish, grits, etc., coming down from North America. And this is what they're exporting back. So here we have a trade which has been described as one of the greatest migrations in recorded history. We know how appalling it was. We know that enslaved labour to the plantations had to be continuously topped up, so people involved in slavery get a lot of money because demand is not drying up. Apparently one third of all slaves imported to Saint-Domingue, which later became Haiti after a slave revolution, they died within 3 years of arrival. A third of them died within 3 years of arrival. But over in Europe, it produced these lovely experience of luxuries and comforts and an ever-increasing demand for sugar and stimulants. Okay, the new colonial trades. Africa, slaves, gold, elephant's teeth, which is how they describe ivory, and there is loads of ivory coming out. From the West Indies, sugar, coffee, cocoa, indigo, and cotton. A lot of this goes up to America, so coffee, indigo, and cotton. You know, you've got your blue jeans and your coffee and you're okay. France, there's this re-exporting sugar and coffee, etc., to Europe, which England doesn't do. England apparently consumes all the sugar that it imports from its own sugar colonies, whereas France exports about 80% of theirs. Ireland, again, salted food out to the Caribbean. In the Spanish Main, you get silver, wood, sarsaparilla and jollop, which are treated as drugs. Jollop, I don't know what it is, but it sounds amazing. My father used to say, have a spoonful of this jollop, but it was always some kind of cough mixture. North America produces tobacco, rice, wood, cotton, wood and pitch. The East Indies, of course, coffee, rice, sugar, spices and cloth. And China, tea, china and silks. And vast amounts of money are made using these things. Now, let's have a look at the slavery, first of all. These are glass beads which we found in the prize papers, used in the slave trade, sent back as a sample, the most popular kind, to reorder in Amsterdam. They're in a Dutch letter. When we first opened it, we thought, oh, how nice, they're sending back something to their child. No, they're not. They're saying, can you provide 10,000 more of these, please? They're very popular with the sellers. And we also have, say, the archive of the major Dutch slave fort at Elmina. They sent back kind of like 5 years' worth of their archive in a ship called the Diamond, which got captured and then recaptured. And it's a huge archive, that one. The general impression of slaving on the west coast of Africa is that it's done through these forts, horrible forts where people are just kept for months and months, and then they go through the door of no return. But we've actually got other examples of different kinds of trading. So we have the Abraham of Nantes, which actually was taken on its way back from the West Indies, so it's laden with sugar. The crew fight and fight, a 100-shot fight, to save their cargo and their investment and their labour. But before she'd come back from the West Indies, she'd gone out to the West Indies with slaves from West Africa. And she had collected them from a place called Epa on the Lagos Lagoon in Nigeria. It's one of the chief ports exporting slaves of this part of the world. So that they're still using boats like pirogues, which the slave traders use as well. And what we have from this ship, the Abraham, is an amazing collection of letters like this, written between the ship and the shore and the ship, So the slaves are picked up in ones and twos all around the lagoon, traded for, and they're sent out to the ship. And the ship stays there for 6 months picking up these people. And we have 826 letters written between the ship and the shore, between the crew on the shore and the captain on the ship. It's incredibly rare to get something like this. We also have the daily register of captives brought aboard, which notes who's brought them in and where they're branded. So here we've got 5 men, 5 women, 1 boy and 1 girl. And we have another register telling how much they cost, what was paid for them. So here is for a large man. We have eau de vie, brandy. So yes, so we've got Bengal handkerchiefs. These other things I think are probably some kind of fabric, but I don't know what they are. And then we've got 2 guns and gunpowder and Holland fabric for 1 man. The Slave Voyages database, which records all slave voyages, said that 375 people were eventually taken on this ship to Martinique. 71 died on the way, and so did 9 of the French crew. So they've got 33 French crew, minus 9, with 375 people under the hatches. And when they get to the Caribbean, it's a colonist's paradise. So not for the slaves, but for everybody else, it is boomtown. They export sugar, coffee and cocoa in vast quantity, particularly Saint-Domingue, and vast numbers of letters. This is what slaves were doing while all this jollity was going on, so in the cane fields. And this is the other trade which happens in the French West Indies and everywhere else in the West Indies, the provision ship. So this is a French provision ship coming over from Bordeaux on a regular route, and it's bringing in red wine, white wine, Dutch beer, Irish beef, and so on and so on. And the captain of the ship takes a warehouse in the main town and decants everything into this warehouse and sits there for 3 months selling odd bits and pieces and delivering cargo to people who've ordered it specially. And some of the things that they do is to send notes down to the warehouse to say, please provide a case of candles or 12 bottles of wine or whatever, and they do them on these playing cards. And this is something which we've noticed particularly, that playing cards are used everywhere as small notes. The Caribbean provided a huge market for luxury and for provisions and luxury goods from Europe. People complained about how well-dressed the free black population was. Now, long-distance voyages, you get even more mail. If you're coming from the other side of the world, there's not that many ships, and so one ship will collect huge numbers of letters for delivery. So the Henriette in 1803, coming all the way from China via Batavia and the Cape of Good Hope, had 1,500 packets of letters, so that's going to be very many more actual letters. This ship is famous for particularly one thing, and it's this very small thing. You see those packets of seeds up there? They were found in this lovely red wallet, which belonged to the supercargo, the manager of the cargo, Jan Becker Teerlink of Flushing. He was, as well as being in charge of an absolutely enormous cargo, he was also a keen naturalist, and when they stopped at the Cape, he went exploring Table Mountain, collected lots of seeds. We found them in 2005, asked Kew Gardens would they still be able to make them grow. And one of them did, and it turned out to be the national flower of South Africa, which I think is really nice. So that's what it's doing at the bottom. That's the very plant growing in Kew Gardens, and it's got quite big. Now, letters in the prize papers, I think, show the giddy expansion of European exploitation of the wider world, but on a really intensely personal scale. They also show the effects of contacts with older civilizations and the disorientation of new perspectives on the world. Look at these 2 young men dressed up in their finery. These are 2 Italian young men from this fantastic painting which I discovered in Rome when I was on holiday recently. It's a family, the mother and her stay-at-home sons over here, dressed up in what look like Chinese goods, maybe, sent back. This is their older brother who's gone as a missionary to China. These are various other clerics in the family who's encouraged him. I think this must be his sister. But anyway, you can see it's an incredibly romanticised version of a young man devoting his life to the church, to spreading the word of the Christian God into another civilization. We happen to have a letter written back, not from China, but from India, by an Italian missionary to his family. And the match of these two was such that I couldn't resist showing this picture, even though technically it's got nothing to do with the slave trade, with the prize papers. This is the letter. Dearest Mother, having encountered a favourable occasion for a Dutch ship which is heading towards Europe, I use the occasion to give you my news. Thanks to the Lord, I am in good and perfect health. Only by accident and by the negligence of the cook, on Friday after the feast of the Corpus Domini, I was intoxicated by copper rust and opium. It's fortunate I noticed it in time that I had medicine in my room. I've been recovering for 5 or more months, and I really doubted I would escape death, being reduced to a pure skeleton in a few days. But by the grace of the Lord and the effect of repeated medicine, I have recovered to perfect health. Now I wait to learn the necessary languages for my ministry. I already know French and Portuguese and have begun to sermonise in Portuguese. I understand and speak some Hindi, but I'm not fluent, it being a very difficult language to write and to pronounce. Other things about customs and way of life I will not write, since they would be believed to be fables. It may be enough for you to know that I am well, and if God will grant me life and health, after my prescribed term here I will return to Europe. My greetings to my sisters, brother-in-laws, nephews and friends, all of them with particular emphasis. I think if you read between the lines of that letter, if you were the mother receiving that letter, you would think, my poor son, what an awful, awful experience. Why is he out there? And he's not even sure he's going to be able to return to Europe. He might be in good health now, but he knows there's lots and lots of obstacles in his way. However, his mother never received this letter. She didn't know if he was alive or dead. We took it. We kept it. And it's these kind of things which I think, I hope you will agree with me, make up the written treasure of the prize papers.
This podcast is copyrighted to the National Archives. All rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License.